This is Barry Schrader doing an oral history tape for the Livermore Heritage Guild. Today I'm interviewing Walt Hecox, and the date is October 29th and October 30th, 1983. It's a Sunday morning, October 30th. And we're interviewing in my home. Walt lives on Olympia Fields Court in San Ramon, is that right, Walt?
That's right.
Okay, tell us a little bit, first of all, about where you were born, where you came from.
I was born in Grass Valley, California. That's a, it's a well-known mining town, I guess, in the Mother Lode country. It was the home of the old Empire and Idaho, Maryland mines. There's one other up there that I know of. The three of them were three of the largest mines in the Mother Lode country. The Empire was particularly well known. I grew up on 40 acres, 4 miles, just about due east of the Idaho-Maryland mine on what used to be then the Banner Hill Road. It's now the Idaho-Maryland Road. You can't find the mine anymore. You can find the place I was born. It's 100 years old. I guess I'll be there in 100 years. I wish I still had it.
And what about your, were you an only child or part of a large family?
I have a sister. That's the extent of the family. I guess that's about it.
What year were you born?
1917. I think they declared war 5 days after I was born, 5 days before or something like that.
Oh, okay. And so you got your early education up there before you moved closer to the Bay Area?
My early education there consisted of going to school for one day and getting kicked out when I was 4 years old.
Where'd you go after that?
We went to Santa Barbara. I started school again at the age of 5, and this time got the whooping cough, so I didn't make it there. I finally got to school in Cupertino, which was where we settled eventually.
Is that because of your father's job, or what?
Well, things were pretty primitive in Grass Valley, where we lived, to this extent. The schoolhouse was a one-room schoolhouse. Dad wanted to get us to where we could have a decent education. He raised potatoes up there. He did pretty well at it, as a matter of fact. But he wanted to get us into an area where we could have a better education. And we actually, while he was looking for a place to settle in Central California, we stayed that one winter at a home that was owned by my grandmother in Santa Barbara, and then we moved to San Jose where Dad went in the insurance business. We moved to Cupertino. Dad bought just a 3-acre acre orchard there, farmhouse. That's about it.
And your mother stayed home and worked?
Oh, yeah.
As a housewife?
Yeah.
Okay.
Women didn't work in those days. Well, you know, men work from sun to sun, women's work is never done, I don't know.
That's right.
She would have told you that.
What were your father and mother's first names?
That was Walter. It was Walter Coffeen. That is a sort of a break-off from the original family name. It was Coffin, C-O-F-F-I-N. And I guess the family, they were kind of snobbish, and they didn't like the sound of Coffin, so they changed it to Coffeen and put a double E where that I is in Coffin. Mom's name was Rose Carrington Barkley.
Yeah,
I don't know where that came. Yeah, she was a Scot. Her mother was a MacDonald, and her father, of course, a Barclay. He had Perkinson Barclay Distillery in Glasgow. Not him, his father did. His father wound up by sending him to Australia. He was a captain in Queen Victoria's Guard. And he was a bad boy. He didn't... Well, he did what is accepted to these days, but it wasn't accepted then. We had our own days and ways, or rather, bedroom, shall we say.
I see. In the captain.
And so he wound up in Australia, where he met my grandmother, who had gone to New Zealand. She had gone to New Zealand for the simple reason that her father, a Highland Scot, beat the whole family regularity. That was standard. That's the way you kept the kids in line in Scotland in those days. And with her, she'd get a beating every Sunday because instead of going to the Presbyterian church where he had sent her, she would go to the Catholic church because it had better music. And that would get her a beating, so she finally ran away from home when she was fairly young and went to New Zealand where she was raised. How she got over to Australia, I don't know. Met my grandfather there and married him. One child was born there, and my mother was born in Australia. Ed Barclay was born at sea, my uncle, on the way to the United States.
Oh, so they immigrated here then?
Yeah.
When they were kids?
Very, very young.
So your parents met up in Grass Valley, or where did they meet when they first...
San Francisco.
Okay.
Dad was going to the University of Illinois, and...
Illinois.
My father's family founded the town of Homer, Illinois, if that means anything to you. I think Homer is a dying village now. And he went to the University of Illinois. And
came to San Francisco.
Well, what he did was, there was a little war. That's what brings everybody to California, it seems. In this case, it was the Spanish-American War. And he went, he was in the Army, but he was with Dewey at Manila, in other words, at the time of the Battle of Manila, Manila Bay, when he was there, when Dewey was there. And I guess he was stationed there for some time after, until he got out of the Army. He went as, you know, a volunteer for, you'll remember the Maine stuff and so forth, you know. And when he returned, he came through San Francisco. He liked San Francisco. He got a job with the railroad, and he stayed in San Francisco. My grandmother by then my grandfather had died, my maternal grandfather. My grandmother was running a boarding house. Dad stayed at the boarding house, and he met my mother.
Let's see then, after you moved down to Cupertino and went to a school, was that where you actually finished high school, or did you move around more before you got to through high school? And finished high school and started writing at San Jose State?
Yeah, we were in Cupertino. Both Dad and Mom were there, well, I guess 1950 to about 48, 49, I guess 47, 48.
And you started San Jose State. Were you interested more in boxing or in journalism at that time? You were in boxing too, weren't you?
Probably girls.
Okay.
Actually, I was interested in journalism. I was also interested. I went there. Got the group's invitation to play football, and I did play a little bit.
Whose invitation?
Doug DeGroote. He was a coach at San Jose, and a very successful coach when I had. And I did play as a freshman. I hurt my foot on a summertime job. Doug never forgave me for that. I fell off a refrigerator car, so I couldn't play football anymore. I was studying. I originally, at the insistence of my father, took a pre-law course, but I found out by then that I could write a little bit, rather odd circumstance. I made a trade-off with my sister. She did a whole semester's typing homework for me in return for me writing a short story type theme for her for an English class. you just didn't know how to write stories. Composition fine, but the story type thing was, it seemed to scare her. So they made the trade-off. She got an A in that composition, and it was eventually published. And of course, I got through my typing course. But with that, I then, I don't like to waste any effort, so I promptly retrieved that composition, and the next time around that I had to do something like that in high school, I turned that in as one of my compositions, and by God, it was right in front of the school assembly. It got me great praise, so I figured, well, I guess I can do that, and that's about the only thing I can do well. So I thought about writing for a living then, and unlike the people who wanted to be a starving artist, I didn't, so I thought about a way to make a living writing, and it appeared to be journalism. So I had wanted to do that. Dad wanted me to be an attorney, have a rather large voice. But I'd been quite successful in high school dramatics. And so I took the pre-legal course just long enough to get some bad grades to convince Dad that it wasn't right for me, and then switched to journalism.
And your career was broken up by going to war, wasn't it?
Well, as my college career wasn't broken up by that. What it was broken up by was the fact that I, one spring day, I had a fight with the girl I had a crush on. I couldn't call her my girlfriend because I think she was just about everybody's girlfriend. But I had a very, very painful discussion with her. I had a very, very painful discussion with my father. And the funds which I had earned the summer before had just about run out. And I was very unhappy, and about then a job came through, an offer of a job in the journalism department at San Jose. I'll never forget, Dwight Mendel begged me not to take it.
Who's Dwight Mendel?
Mendel, B-E-N-T-E-L. He founded the journalism department at San Jose State. He is now a professor of journalism in Washington. He's the same man who, some 40 years later, nominated me for a Pulitzer Prize.
Same poetry.
Anyway, I took it. It was $10 a week for a newspaper called The Good to Be Girl. To hell with everything. And I went to the college and told them I was going to drop out, and they said, you can't drop out. You're not ready to leave school. And I said, well, I'm going to anyway. What about, what are you going to do about that? They said, you won't drop out, but we'll keep you in school, and at the end of the quarter, we'll kick you out. And that's about what they did. They have since have reinstated me. I'm in good standing at San Jose State College. Anyway, the Globe, the daily newspaper, in a town of 1,941 people on the banks of the Feather River right at the end of the Depression in 1938. It was a very, very wet winter. It rained for 19 consecutive days when I was there. And remember, I used to have to check the height of the Feather River every night, see whether and when it was going to flood. I remember I would get so wet that I would have the pattern of the dye on some of my clothing on my body when I come in from that.
What was the dye from?
Well, actually, it was the shorts that I was wearing, my underwear.
The clothing got so soaked it went right through.
Got so soaked I'd wind up with blue and white stripes on my... Anyway,
what kind of a paper was it, Gridley? Evening Globe, an old letterpress afternoon daily?
It was an afternoon daily. Had one line of type, had an old oh, what do you call those presses, the ones with the big flag on them?
Flatbed to revolution.
Yeah, flatbed press. And hand-fed. Had one linotype, one linotype operator who had to hold the linotype together with one hand while he operated with the other. No time to take proofs. Some really ridiculous errors, if I don't include in this. Really funny ones, sir. Typos. One helper back there who all melted the metal for the linotype and who ran the press and who swept the floor and who put the handset type back in the cases where it belonged, things like that. One editor, his name was Dave Lloyd, he was an Andrew State graduate. He was an old man, he was 24. I remember he wore a Humbert hat. And me. I never forget when I walked in the place. I walked in the front door of the place, and the publisher said, oh, you're a Walt Hitchcock boy. The other fellow was right back there, with my other back there. Dave was sitting at hunched over a typewriter, wearing an overcoat. It was really cold, raining outside, a rickety old building. And there was a pot-bellied stove in this long, narrow room. By long and narrow, I mean the room was probably 15 feet long, but maybe 8 feet wide. From that pot-bellied stove, I don't know exactly why it was in that end of the room, there was a stovepipe protruding that went to the ceiling, and then in a series of rather agonized joints, moved the length of the room and across the room to where it entered the chimney just above what Dave Loing pointed out as my desk. And Loing says, oh, you're Hitchcock, say. Where's your desk? Sit down. He was being a real tough veteran. I said he was all 24. Oh, man, I was, that was, believe it or not, my 21st birthday. That day was. So I sat down. And just as I sat down, that stovepipe came free from that chimney, and all the soot that was in that chimney came down right on top of my head. Loing turned around, looked at me, and says, that damn thing, it's always doing that. Clean it up, will you? That was my introduction to the newspaper business.
How long did you stay there?
Until it went broke, which wasn't long. I work 14 hours a day. I get up in the morning, and I work at the rewrite and calling the police beat and calling other beats and things like that. And I'd go out and cover whatever story had to be covered, whatever happened that way, and write some headlines. Do the routine worker of a sort of a general clunky on a newspaper. At 4 o'clock, when we got the newspaper out, why, I'd go out and deliver a route for the circulation department. That's how I got my gas to give me gas for that. And then I'd go home and have dinner, and then I'd come back and work on a special edition until 11, 12 o'clock. Back at it, 7 o'clock the next morning. Well, we got Sundays there.
Sundays.
Might have been better if we didn't. As an old codger pointed out to me when I walked into the Gridley Hotel, my first Sunday at Gridley, asked what a man did on Sundays in this town. He said, son, there's only two things you can do in this town ever. You can go to church or you can get drunk. sat and thought that over for a minute and said, I ain't been to church in 40 years myself.
Let's see, you said that the paper went broke, and was that after a year or so there? And then you kept moving?
About 6 months.
Okay, and then you moved on back to school, or?
No. I went back to San Jose, and I couldn't find a job in the newspaper business, except I went to work for Buddy Leach on the news, writing sports. Total salary of nothing a week for the experience. For my money, I worked as an installment collector for a place called the Hollywood New Style Tailors. It was a suit club. I collected the installments for it. I got in and out of some very interesting places for it now. You must be out of tape or something.
No, I had shut the door and left it either. Fine. Okay, so that was a job while you were working for free, writing sports.
That's right. And I wrote sports for the news until I got a hot tip. Kate. Remember the Wallace polo team? Team came to me with a fellow from the team, and he had really a mangled eye. And they were all very angry at their coach, a fellow named Charlie Walker. And Walker had never liked me when I went to college, because I had was assistant sports editor, Sparky Bailey. I had given considerable publicity to for minor sports, to my favorite minor sport, and the one that we were most successful in, and that was boxing. And Charlie Walker deeply resented that, because he had a very good swimming team, too, and we did have a very good swimming team, some very notable athletes in it. But we weren't winning Pacific Coast Championships, and we were in a boxing team. Anyway, that's beside the point, except that this fellow, who I'd known, in fact, he was the son of the man who had been the principal of the high school I went to, Fremont High School, San Diego. And told me that the Waters polo team was going to strike. And I said, are you sure of this? Can I talk to some others? He got me to talk to others. Yes, they were going to strike, absolutely. So I went to Buddy and I told him, and I said, you've got to keep this a secret. I said, it's strictly off the record, because they haven't struck yet, you know. By God, Buddy came out with an edition that afternoon. He had just one little paragraph in boldface, pretty high on the sport page. Will the San Jose water polo team strike? Well, that afternoon, Walker's wife owned the chain of Primus. And that afternoon, every kid that water polo team got a job at Waterbury Creamery's. And there was no strike. And Betty Good got me in there, into his office. There was a misunderstanding. And Bud was still sore at me for getting hurt and not playing football my last 3 years there. He never did really forgive me for that. Not for about 20 years anyway. And said he, obviously I had published something false. I said, how do you know I did it? He says, well, nobody else could have learned things like that except you, because hell. No, I'm not going to tell him that Buddy did it without my permission, you know. I can't have you reporting on this campus any longer. I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't see how you can stop me, but I went back and told Buddy what happened, and Buddy said, well, I'm going to have to take you off to San Jose State Beach and put you on high school beach for a while. Well, that was just too big a come down for my ego. About that time, because I couldn't sell suits as well as collect them for them, I just couldn't sell those things. They were good suits, but the people that were buying them couldn't afford it. And I also didn't really, really go with the places that a lot of the salesmen went to sell these things. I think it was every Thursday or Friday morning, Wednesday morning, I went along to Palm Street, which was what the Red Light District in San Jose, and made a collection from all the girls at the houses there, and they were customers and going for sale. And the gambling joints, there were quite a few of them in those days on the El Camino Real. There were a lot of them. This is sort of jumping in, both totally flooded. They were big gambling areas behind them. They were burned down all of the elevation. Bingo Mendoza. It's a nice colorful name. And he's a colorful guy, he looked like a frog. A dark complexion frog. Anyway, they fired me. Day before Christmas. 6 months later, they tried to hire me back, by the way. Turned out I was the only honest installment collector that they had. They'd ever, ever, ever had. All the rest had stolen me from them. So I went out desperately looking for a job, and I looked at the Sunnyvale Standard, which was a weekly newspaper published in Sunnyvale, which was just 3 miles from Cupertino, which is where I lived. And I saw it had no Cupertino news, so I went out very aggressively. I really read the riot act to the publisher there. I told him he had no Cupertino news, he ought to hire someone to do it, and I was available and waiting to hire me. Mm-hmm. By God, he put me to work for 3 days a week at $4 a day as his Cupertino reporter. And I went. Roy and Dusty Street went out and got the news. And took it my own typewriter, wrote the news, had it all written up, had a stack of it about this thick. It's a weekly newspaper. I hadn't worked for anything but dailies until then. Even in college, it was a daily, you know.
Right.
And I knew when his deadline, he told me when the deadline was, it was Wednesday or something like that. And on Wednesday, I showed up in Sunnyvale with all this cheap stuff. And his wife looked at me and she wasn't there. She said, "Oh, John is at home." He called me and told me to tell you to go there. So I went. But what John had done was call Mary Tiedemann and say, "Have that kid Heacox come in when he gets here. I'm going to fire him."
Oh, no.
He didn't fire me. I handed him the copy and he looked at it. He was really impressed. And he read all the copy. Said, "Walt, next time," he said, "will you bring this in as you get it on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and not do it this way?"
Stretch out the typesetting job, right. So how long did you last there?
So, well, what happened was he had an editor, a fellow he hired, he always called himself the editor, but a fellow from Sanford that he hired to do the editor's work at the paper. And he had him when I got there. And I was there for about 2 or 3 weeks. John, who was always hurting for money, rural papers were in those days, he got rid of the guy from Stanford and gave me the job. I started out at $16 a week and got up to about $24. I had that job for about 3 years, I guess, and I finally quit. I got mad at John because he cut my pay, so he... It was a very odd thing, and I behaved, like I behaved a lot of times in my life. But tree like a Kello kit then. The back shop was union, and it consisted of just two people, a printer and an apprentice. And both of them, they were related. One was the nephew of the other, the apprentice was the nephew of the printer. And they both told me joyously for two or three days, really been needing me about it. My pay was going to be cut because the union had demanded a $4 a week raise for Delbert, and that $4 a week was going to come out of my check. I didn't believe it. By God, come Friday, there was my check lay on my desk, and it was $4 short. So I just sat down. John wasn't in the office, and he'd worked late. I used to stay up to get the paper in the mail. I'd stay up all night on Thursday nights and Friday morning. And John wasn't at the office yet. The check was there. I don't know how it got there, but I probably might have been floating on some other day. Anyway, I just put the check in an envelope and wrote a note and said, if I'm not worth more than this after 3 years, I'm not worth a goddamn cent, and walked out of the place.
That was it.
I was broke, of course. So I went to South San Francisco and got a job at the steel mills for a month. Worked in the open hearth furnace for a month or so. Got enough money so I could look for another newspaper job.
That must
have
been, mid-20s?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in along.
Mid-20s? How old do you think I am?
No, you said you got out of school in seven. No, I'm sorry. No, you were born in 1917. It would be the late 30s then? Was that before World War?
About 19. You were born in, it would have been about 41.
Yeah, was that before
it was
World
40.
War?
They were building Camp Roberts. World War II was on, but we weren't in. And I hitchhiked. Went to CNPA, and they told me there was a job in Paso Robles. And I hitchhiked to Paso Robles. And they offered me a job in this newspaper. The newspaper really looked like it was starting, because I knew there was another newspaper that was very prosperous in South Paso Robles. And there was no place to live, but they offered me $25 a week and a little storage room in the newspaper to sleep in. And I was scared of the whole situation. I'd worked for one newspaper before I broke. So I started hitchhiking to Santa Barbara to see if maybe I couldn't get a job on the news press. Well, a young man picked me up and asked me what I was doing, and I told him. He said, oh, you've been to college? Yeah. I said, how would you like to go to work for me? I can offer you $35 a week. And he said, I can get you a room and board for practically nothing. I can get you meals and a place to sleep for $10 a week. And good meals. I said, doing what? He says, as a field timekeeper for Floyd J. Thwaites and Morrison and Newton, the companies that are building Camp Roberts. And I said, I know nothing about timekeeping. He says, all you have to do is mark numbers in a square. So I worked there until I was drafted. And they drafted me. I went up to Cupertino. They put me in... they'd have a contingent of kids from each town with each draft, you know. They put me in charge of this contingent. We went away from the railroad station with the band playing and everything.
What year was this, 41?
40. 40. Or early 41. Well, it was still 40, I think. I had a very low draft number. And, to get up to San Francisco. By God, that night, guess who the only person was to come back to Cupertino? I was really ashamed of myself. They put me in class 4F.
Why?
My eyes. My the squiggly eyes and the nystagmus, you know, they move all of the... It was a non-correctable defect. And that was my vision. It wasn't too bad. It was 1820 and 1620, I think, you know. Which, you know, anybody else get by, but it was non-correctable. They couldn't forgive that. Now it is correctable. And it was then, too, but they didn't know much about it. So anyway, I got myself then, almost immediately, a job at what was then the Joshua Hindy Iron Works, and I went to work right back in the back where they built the, as a machinist helper, where they built the steam engines. And I was making, with overtime, a tremendous sum of about $89 a week. And I worked the swing shift or the midnight shift, and that gave me all day to work as the swing beat reporter for the San Jose Mercury, which I did. So I worked the two jobs for about a year. In the meantime, met Betsy Hanser, who was playing Stanford at the time. And married her.
Betsy
Hanser.
Oh,
and she was a journalist position at Stanford. And Pearl Harbor came along, and then it was really, really embarrassing. People would look at me and they'd have kids that weighed 135 pounds soaking wet, you know, and they're in the service. And there I am. I've been on all these athletic teams. I've never been a great athlete. Don't ever kid yourself about that. I captained the high school football team, but that's because I'd played so long. I knew about football, you know. I didn't necessarily know how to handle my body, but I knew what to be, you know, how to handle the other guys. Boxing, I think I was a fair boxer out of sheer fear. But also a lot of practice as a kid with my 20 hours left in the equipment. I started to try to join the Marine Corps. Well, first they called me up for the draft again, and once again sent me back, which I was about half expected then. I started to try to join the Marine Corps. And I must have gone up to that place about 10, 12 times, taking my physical. And finally I passed their eye test with flying colors. And the corpsman gave me the test. He says, look, he says, you passed the test, but you know you can't pass it. I know you can't pass it. The Marine Corps knows you can't pass it. Now you know all these tricks by heart.
Oh. Okay.
He says, now why don't you go over there to the Navy and you'll read it off perfect the first time and you go right in. He says, but do something to study those eyes down first. So I went to Doc Wiesner in Sunnyvale and he gave me some Nembutal. He gave it to me in a bottle. Bottles of every size. I said, just take a little bit of this. Well, I wanted to be sure, so I took about half the bottle. Boy, my eyes were steady. But I went just zooming right through that test, and all of a sudden I was in the Navy. I had also married Betsy at the same time. About, you know, I got down to the Naval Training Station. Up through boot camp, passed their general classification test pretty high, so I had my choice of any school I wanted to go to just about. discovered that all those schools required eyes. So I finally settled on Hospital Corps School because you could pick the station if you wound up in the top 10% of the class. I wound up fifth in the class of 500. And I didn't cheat. Some of those guys did. In fact, the guy that was first came to me and congratulated me and says, "Well, I think I'd have done as well as you if I hadn't cheated too." I chose Treasure Island and got it. Betsy and I spent a very happy 3 weeks together, and then they, believe it or not, after all the fuss and all this, not being able to join the Marine Corps, they transferred me to the medical arm of the Marine Corps, and that's where I spent the rest of the war, with a Marine platoon in combat in the Solomons.
Just a couple of years in Solomon Islands then?
Well, I was down there about a year. In the tail end of the Guadalcanal campaign and the first wave of the landing on Burgundy and a couple of other actions in this game. That was a very good thing.
You got injured there?
Shot.
And Bowmanville is where you were injured?
I was, that was the big one. We were in a storm, and it stands to reason. I suppose I'd have been scared to death if I'd really known how much danger I was in, but it stands to reason that when I did was hit with a sniper and you had to go get him, the sniper was still there, and there was a good chance he'd get you. Well, this was more than a sniper. It was a pocket of resistance in an area that had been devastated by our artillery fire. But you have to fight in the jungle to know what fighting in the jungle is like. You really can't see anything until you're right on top of it, and that's true. You have to have exceptional eyes to see anything. Somehow or another, we got to a point where we were a big, big U, the battalion was. This was on Thanksgiving Day, 1943. Around extending with M Company and probably K on one side, the headquarters on the other. Around L Company, which would have been the bottom of the U, the indentation. And I've been with L Company. And L Company had run into one of those pockets of resistance. And the resistance was very, very heavy when you got it. It was heavy machine gun fire. Well, it was light machine guns, but it was very heavy fire. Heavy rifle fire, grenades. And very hard to spot, and this whole company, I remember Captain Kovacs calling all of the non-coms in, and then outlining for us, or getting a report from them, squad by squad, and every single squad commander had his whole squad pinned down by machine gun fire. The Vicky's guns, Japanese taking, I guess we did too, they call it infiltrating fire. They'd open lanes through the jungle and they would fire machine gun patterns across each other so you couldn't possibly get through one of these things without going through one of those patterns. And of course, the only way to get through it was to get below it. You certainly couldn't jump over it, not very safely anyway. Anyway, I've been awfully busy all morning. We had a lot of casualties. I'd been in pretty heavy combat 2 days before. We'd been promised about 4 or 5 days rest, and we got all of one. And I had run out of stretcher bearers several times and hauled these guys out of trouble on my back myself. And on one occasion, I remember one of the guys, I'd have to prop him against a tree and then pull myself up out of the mud and then go on a little ways. And even when you got an emaciated Marine on your back, well, that gets a little bit tiresome after a while. But I was tired. Went to headquarters company for more supplies. Sitting on a log at about 11 corner. The colonel couldn't establish contact with the company commander of L Company. Well, it turns out that Kovacs was about 3/4 dead by that. He lived through it. I thought at the time, I thought he died, but he didn't. When he couldn't establish contact, he finally just yelled. And he kept getting these answers. Put so-and-so, he'd give the code name on, get it back. So-and-so is dead. And it kept coming that way. So finally, he sent a runner to L Company. But what happened is, the runner crossed across a clearing in the bottom of the belly of the U. So he was in front of the front lines. And it was immediately hit in the femur. Fell back over a log, so the femur was lying, was broken right here, and so that just bent like that over the log. Very, very difficult situation because there was no way in the world I could think of to move that guy. We sat there. I was at the end of the line of these corpsmen, closest to this, and I looked at them and I'm thinking, you guys have been here in this battalion aid station while I've been out there working, and they look at me thinking, well, he's closest. He goes. So finally I just sighed and I went, and I remember. I got to the edge of the clearing and the kid was just yelling his head off. And I yelled out to her, this and that, oh, so-and-so. Except I didn't say so-and-so. If you don't shut up, I'll never get out there. Because I'm not going to have all that attention called to me going out there. And the kid shut up. And I ran out there, and it was like running in slow motion because the mud came just about up to my ankles. And you can't run very fast in that. And about halfway there, I got hit.
The interview with Walt Hecox. Go ahead about the when you were hit.
Well, anyway, I don't really think the wound itself would have been that bad a wound. It was a dum-dum bullet, which meant it expanded as it hit my leg. It just barely brushed. Not enough to do any permanent damage, but to make it almost impossible for me to walk with a femoral nerve. And it wiped out a great many of the lymph glands and the branch of the femoral artery, not the main femoral artery. And I don't think any of that would have been too bad, but I got to the hospital, and it was just a leg wound, and I got between, the fellow on my right had been shot through the stomach, and the fellow on my left shot through the testes. And I was kind of ashamed of a lousy little leg wound, which was a pretty big one at that. When the doctor come by in the morning and asked how I was, I'd say I was fine. I couldn't walk on it, we both knew that. Because we tried. Actually, the battalion surgeon had come down and begged me to try so that I'd come back to duty if I could walk. I need Corbin. And I just couldn't walk on it. And so I went on for about 5 days till the guys around me started to complain about the smell. The doctor looked at the wound in the street. So they rushed me down to Galvadon. Put me in amputation ward there, just about to get crazy. But I did a debridement. And really cut a hole in that leg there. Then put in a ski splint, an attraction, and sent me directly to Guadalcanal because I had thought they'd cut my leg off, but when I couldn't feel the doll of God. And this very religious doctor, I had to... I had improved his vocabulary somewhat when I came out of it, but I accused him of everything. Well, I kept trying to show me my leg, but it didn't look like a limp to me, it had a cast on. Anyway, he couldn't stand having me on the island with him anymore. Well, on Guadalcanal, the same thing happened. They just left the damn leg in the damn ski splint. So it began to atrophy, and also the joint began to stiffen. So by then you had three things. You had a huge hole by then, you had very bad atrophy, and you had a joint stiffening.
Yeah.
Well, by the time I got home, it was worse than that because malaria had showed up. I had a bad stomach condition. God knows what all. I had a good job with all the time I got there.
You say you got home, back stateside?
Mm-hmm. Well, because, you see, by the time they finally did get that splint off, I couldn't move my knee. That just was something that progressively got worse. So it wasn't very bad to begin with. And it's understandable, all of it. Because they had other problems. But whatever it was so bad it got me out of the service.
So where'd you head up? Where'd you head home to?
Well, what they sent me to Okinawa, and from there I went for about a month, because they were determined you were going to be as healthy as you could to I've lost the word. Not rehabilitation, but really, the hospital I've been recovering here in Santa Cruz, which is really an old hotel. And before I went down there, I'd gone to the phone book and met myself a job.
About
45, isn't it? That
was 44.
Right, 44. The wife was still up in San Francisco. She was, but by then she'd said, meet Percy.
Did what?
She'd said, meet Percy.
What's that expression?
Percy was a professional Irishman who lived in San Francisco and who took up with my wife while I was in.
Oh, okay.
All right.
That's a breakup, okay.
And lived in San Francisco and who took up with my wife while I was in.
Oh, okay. All right. That's a breakout. Okay.
And I got out of the Navy on the 21st of June. I went to work for Paul on the 22nd. I was a reporter doing one paragraph he writes, the first of which took me about 2 hours to do, and then stamped down. just scared to death. Then I got sent. That's how they tested me on a murder case one after one morning, I guess. So, yeah, the best result for the news, but on a rather tawdry little murder up in Santa Rosa. I found out later when Murray said that the result was being back. He nodded to the city desk, which indicated I was all right. If he checked me his head, I would have been fired. The acid test, and as soon as they found that out, they had a kid who did a lot of playing around, which I suppose I did, but no, I didn't know as much as that. On the night beat, and anyway, they took him off the night beat, and they put me on the night beat, because I couldn't think I passed the test on government cop stuff that day. I was just calling. Started writing for magazines, whatever.
That's when you started your first freelancing. Salary stand had nothing to do with that, right?
Well, only insofar as I probably wouldn't have met Ed Sullivan if it hadn't been for Sally.
Who's Ed Sullivan?
Ed Sullivan was the night manager of International News Service, which was one of the two forerunners of UPI. And he was a very good friend of Fred Walker, the city editor of The Call, who was a very good friend, for the sake of convenience, with Sally Stanford's. I've told you that story. You want that on tape?
Oh. Briefly, if you can get
more briefly, I'll
get more into it.
Well, it just was a very simple thing that Sally got herself in an embarrassing position one night. We got a picture of her in the hospital, bending over her former husband and kissing him on the forehead after he tried to commit suicide. The picture appeared on page one. I and my photographer, Jimmy Nepper, were responsible for that picture and story running. The managing editor got a hold of it before Fred Walker did. That made Fred Walker very angry with me. And it made Sally Stanford very angry with Fred, or ostensibly so. Anyway, that's how Ed Sullivan got a hold of me to get me to tell Sally what I had done so that she would forgive Fred. When I told her what I had done, she said, "Oh, I'm not really mad at Fred about that. I'm just mad that he comes here when he gets drunk to sleep off he's drunk and he never spends a goddamn cent."
Okay. And that's when you got your first article. Oh, Esquire, was it?
Well, I sold the story to Esquire long before I met Sullivan, but I would just study things I didn't know what to do, and Sullivan, while he was talking to me before he went to Sally's, told me how and where and who to get in touch with to write fact detective stories. Those are two detective stories. And what markets to contact, and I did, and it's been very lucrative for me for 40 years.
Left the Call Bulletin after 5 years, why did you leave there?
I don't know, I'm going to write a book.
I'm going to write a book. You got the McClashes?
No, I've been doing very well with the magazines. I've been selling a fair amount of fiction to pulps, mostly. The detective stories. And there was this book that I sold, this story I sold to Esquire, that the Atlantic Monthly Press wanted me to expand into a book, which I did, which wasn't very successful at all. And I remember I did it up. Stupid.
I'll get that. Yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, I, we went, we kept our flat in San Francisco. Jeanette, my caller, my real first wife, I was married to Jeanette 25 years. You know her, I think.
Well, you married her then when you were working for Carl Bolton?
Yeah.
Okay. What was Jeanette's maiden name?
Hoffman.
Jeanette Hoffman.
We took a cabin at the lake, which I paid for by running a ski tow on the weekends.
Which lake?
Big Taco. There's only one lake.
All right.
Did a lot of writing that winter, and I really made very good money, but I didn't get paid for most of it until about the middle of July, and by then I was scared to death, flat broke, and working for the Sacramento Bee. And Eleanor McClatchy on the Bee liked the way I wrote history, so I wrote quite a bit of history, a lot of historical features for a history of the Virginia Kentucky Railroad, the history of Columbia, a historical column for the editorial page. And the way I left that is probably, perhaps, funny. I loved the McClatchys. I thought they were great people. I thought they were great historians. I'd become very close to C.K., and Eleanor trusted me. She didn't stutter around me. I mean, she didn't stutter around anybody. That meant she knew them and, you know, liked them.
Hmm.
There was a problem with all this popularity with the McClatchys, and that was certain junior editors you wouldn't be that popular with. But there was also an older man named Moore who was managing editor, but in name anyway. Max DePue was managing editor. Moore was just waiting until the time he could retire, and all he edited was the editorial page. So he chew one of our rear ends out every day of the week. And for really minuscule things, he called me in this time, and I had called a barkentine, or something that small, and I still can't remember quite what the difference is. It has to do with something with the forceps. They just really chewed my rear end out. And I also knew it was September, and I knew I was going to have to cover the state fair again. And I didn't want to do that. A miserable, miserable assignment. But I walked out of Moore's office just absolutely steaming. Walked up to George Helmer, the city editor's desk, and said, George, I can't stand that old son of a bitch another 5 minutes. And this very quiet voice behind me said, you don't have to, Mr. Peacock, you don't have to. So there's always been some controversy about whether I quit or was fired from the Bee. I maintain I was fired, they maintain I quit. Of course, that person behind me was that old son of a bitch. Freelance very successfully for quite a few years after that. Everything fell into place for a lot of the time. A lot of chicken and some feathers. A couple of times things got kind of thin, but mostly it worked out pretty well. And then television started to eat into the magazines that I wrote for. And one year I remember a dozen of them died in one Christmas. About Christmas is when they let you know those magazines aren't going to publish anymore.
Hmm.
That's because they're making their plans for the next year's finances, you know. So, well, folks, that looked like it was really going to do great until I got into trouble with a completion contract on one book. And I couldn't get the completion payment until I made some revisions the editor wanted me to make. The editor was sick, and by God, he was sick for one solid year. The agent didn't tell me. I sat around waiting for some money on that book until I was desperate. Went to Johnny Howe, the editor of the Mercury, and asked him if he'd get me a circulation job or anything just so I could keep going for a little while. He says, well, there's a job open in the news register in a few months. He says, you can be editor of that paper in a month. I was wrong. But I was the editor in 3 months.
That's when you first met Fenn Trimper, just the editor of the news register. That was when, what year was that about? Remember, 63. Okay. That's when it was owned by who now? It was owned by Oakes or Kaufman?
That was owned by George Oakes.
George Oakes was before Kaufman or after Kaufman?
He sold it to Kaufman.
You left there after a year then?
Oh, it was about 3 years.
3 years. The news register, okay. And it still was going. Had the Argus started up against it yet?
He hadn't made a very serious move, though. We weren't worried about it.
But Sparks had started the Argus before, by 66, when we were still...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And what happened after 66?
Well, Kaufman bought the paper. Don't forget the fuss George made about me being the first to know. I could have shot him for it. I really like George Oakes. A lot of people in the newspaper business don't. I do. Dick Treat, the assistant publisher, who actually works for a company that wanted to buy that thing, took a job as publisher of a Camden newspaper in New Jersey and asked me to go back there with him just to write a column. And I said, Dick, I said, you know anywhere in the world but Camden? Well, I tried to work with Steve for a while.
Steve who?
Oh, Kaufman.
Well, Steve, his son, was the editor.
Yeah.
You were managing editor?
Oh, I was editor.
Oh.
My title there was editor, I'm pretty sure. Oh. Might have been managing. Yeah, I think it was managing editor. I forget. It's always a fine line whether they call you editor or managing editor, depending on...
what the publisher does.
Mm-hmm. And anyway, I came to a parting of ways with Steve very spectacularly. He told me something was going to be one way, and I told him... if that's the way the fellow, he'd better get himself another editor or a city councilman in one night.
You had to say
so I wound up, it must have made some noise because for some reason or another, the publisher of the Sanger Herald knew I didn't have a job. What he didn't know was I had a job promised with a chain of newspapers in Southern California. And he called me up and said his editor was had an automobile accident and was going to be out of work for weeks and weeks and weeks, and that I pieced him down and put out his paper. Be surprised how many jobs cropped up just like that.
Huh.
Bingo. Guy up in the other side of Sacramento wanted me to come up there, and somebody up in Oregon. No, Washington. Anyway, I didn't turn down old Seymour Sterling because Sterling was a former president of the CMPA and I didn't see how I could. And I wasn't too sure I wanted to go to San Diego. So I went down there. I was there for about 3 months until I had to hire my own replacement. Obviously, he wasn't going to hire me. That was fun. I had a good time in San Diego. Didn't spend my life in San Diego. And came back. And the guy in San Diego, meanwhile, paid my expenses to come down and look over his plant and everything. Offered me a pretty good sum to come down there, and I went down there and made this paper.
In San Diego itself?
South of San Diego. Management City, Chula Vista, Imperial Beach.
Chain of dailies or weeklies?
Tri-weeklies.
Tri-weeklies.
All local news, huge papers. 44 to 60 pages, most editions. Very small staff and very, very, very badly paid. Very badly paid. I wasn't, but they were. When you got bad pay, you got bad luck. I used to go to work at 7 o'clock in the morning for those things, and I'd finish at 3 o'clock the next morning. Yeah, I think that was right inside the same thing. Brownie wrote him a letter and told him I was going to leave. So, he said, well, if you're going to leave, he said, I've got somebody, you might as well leave now. Because I got a chance to get somebody now, I might not have one in 6 weeks, you know, the hell with you, right? So I came back up here, and I was really, really tired. And I got Phil Hirsch ordered a whole flock of stories from me, just one right after another.
Phil Hirsch was from
whom? It was Pyramid Books. He edited Man's Magazine. Well, they paid about $400 a story, and I was making about that, selling a story about a week to them. I knew it couldn't last. You know, because it's a monthly magazine. There's only a couple of them. And, well, let me get my wind.
It's in 67, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I walked into the International Fiction Bar one day and saw Ben Kubrick, and he said, Pete Winslow's trying to get a hold of you. So I called Winslow, and he says, how'd you like to come to work for the Independent? And I said, I've only got one question. Do I only work an 8-hour day? No more, ever. Absolutely, nothing more than an 8-hour day.
What story? A line, yeah. So that's when you met Pete the first time, you knew him?
Oh, no, Pete had worked for me.
Oh, it's in Register, News Register?
In the News Register, yeah, he was my Sunday editor. It's terrible. I used to joke about it, that because it wasn't true. I think that of all the people that worked for me, I don't think I ever yelled at Pete or got mad at him or anything, because Pete was really, when Pete wanted to be, he was highly confident. He could also be a complete, you know, go off the deep end on something and be a complete jerk, but he was highly confident on the whole, and thorough and fair.
He replaced Dana McGraw.
He had replaced Dana McGraw when Dana died. He had already quit the News Register. He just quit the News Register to write poetry. Pete was always doing that. There was an erratic side to Pete, don't kid yourself, but he was a good newspaper man. He wanted to be a very good man, a very, very fine person, I thought. Nutty, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. Anyway, well, I went to work for the News Register for Peanuts.
The Independent.
Yeah, the Independent. But it was just like having a vacation for me. Because just being a reporter didn't seem like very hard work. And just writing stories and getting stories and going to city council meetings, things like that, just didn't seem to, I didn't really feel like I was working hard at all. Then it got into something, they wanted help with the sports thing, and they asked me if I'd help out Ken Ciccoli. Well, Ken was a 19-year-old kid, 18 years old at the time, who was well, he was very proudly a member of the New Left, you know, which was not unusual at the Independent. I remember when I covered my first Dublin ECSD meeting. I guess it was about my third one. And there was a Scot named Nelson. Was it Nelson who was on the city council, the ECSD board over there?
Was that Byron Nelson?
No, not Byron Nelson.
That's
Aiken. That's Byron Aiken.
Yeah.
I think this guy's name was Nelson. Anyway, he came back from vacation and he said something about the press. He was told to hush up to him. He said, there was no member of the press here. He was told, I think, by really sweet woman.
Ann Jolly?
Ann Jolly, yeah. But there was two. He was a member of the Independent there. Peters are in the audience. Says, it can't be. He said, why not? Nobody out there with a beard.
Barefoot, yeah.
But, anyway, after Ken was, he was one of his kids, he was pretty violently that way. He made one terrible remark, which I won't quote. The castle was nothing wrong. Ken's a fine kid and a fine young man now. He's going to Syracuse University, I believe.
Tukola?
Tukola.
T-U-K?
T-U-C-C-O-L-I, I think.
But you replaced him then?
No. No, they wanted me to help him out. And I said, absolutely not. I said, my life would be miserable if I was helping him out. It just won't work. So then they came to me the next week and they said, well, we want you to keep on covering the city council and doing this, that, and the other. But we also would like you to be sports editor. Of course, that was hard on poor Ken as it was on me the other way around. He took it all right, I think. He started doing a lot of other things. So that wound me up with two jobs, and, you know, the end of the 8-hour day, the end of all the fun. Although I still had fun because I got a bunch of kids around me for stringers who, they were really loyal and they were nice kids and I enjoyed them tremendously. And I really, 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 of all the things I've done, I think I enjoyed the high school sports in the Valley as much as anything. The city council meeting, and I, with all due respect to Don Miller, the city council meetings became a drag because you would get these deliberate repetitions, and you remember them better.
Oh, yes.
And they would say, I'm going to, and particularly Don, and I'm going to deliver speech number 576, you know, and then launch into it. And after, you know, you'd sat through that enough times, and you have your opinion, you couldn't answer, you just had to sit here and listen.
Right.
And that got to be not quite as much fun as it used to be, but the sports were always fun, and the kids were just wonderful, and I remember a few in particular, and there's one whose name that I can't, and I want that name on this, but it's going to be there. And I can't think of his name now, it should be, but this... It's Don, oh God, it's just a fringe of my conscience. But the kid who had, what's that disease?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, go ahead, then you were in the middle of talking about sports and people you worked with in sports.
Well, I think I probably is alone now.
Yeah.
Well, I probably, oh, I think in the long run I probably enjoyed the sports, the high school sports more than anything I ever did in the newspaper business. And there are people I remember like, now there is another name that I know it so well, but it's slipping me. The basket, Skip Mohack.
Oh, sure.
In Pleasanton, who was probably the best high school coach that I ever knew. He could produce winners and he could produce men at the same time. And I don't think it was because of his condition. I think it was because he had that little special thing that makes a relationship between an adult and a teenager that very few of us have, and certainly I never had. Never would have.
Is that how you get to know Alfred Bogut through sports?
But they... No. No, Al was a news source. The best news source in Livermore. There was nothing Al didn't know. He had selected a member of the city council when he died, and I will almost guarantee you that had Al not have died when he did, that man would have been elected to city council. And I forget who it was.
Maybe close to Harris.
It wasn't Medeiros, it wasn't Manuel. There was they were friends, but there was a wide span between Manuel Medeiros and Al Capodio. Maybe not so much in thinking, because they both were, as perhaps is proper, they were both rugged individualists. Yeah, that's probably why each of their families came to this country, so they could be individualists. That's probably why we're all here. But Manuel and Al were two different people. Manuel was a wonderful person. I think his favorite memories of Livermore were when he was running a barbershop when he was much, much younger than when either you or I knew him. And there was a young fellow who used to run in from, I believe, the area was known as either Lone Oak or Twin Oaks or something like
Twin
that.
Twin Oaks Ranch, yeah.
Anyway, it was on the ridge, that very low ridge out there by a Royal Road. As you dip down from, what's the highway that goes to Fremont from Livermore? 84, yeah. If you come around that curve, that's about where it is. And this fellow used to run in from there and towel himself off in Manuel Medeiros' barbershop and then run back to Twin Oaks. And Manuel had a very active part in having this young man turn into a professional prize fighter. His name was Max Baer. It's funny, and Max's success and really his downfall, it all came and it started in Livermore. It was a Livermore girl who wrecked him with a, can you believe this, in this day and age, a breach of promise. How do you like that, breach of promise? Wouldn't that, I wonder how many of those they could file in Livermore today. They don't make promises anymore though, do they? But it was Manuel who was a friend of Ansel Hoffman, who became Bear's manager, who turned Baer on the road to the World Championship. And unfortunately, Baer managed in his own inimitable, excuse me, it's my If I had my own mouth instead of a bridge, I could pronounce that word. But it was Hoffman to whom Bear sold the first 50% of himself. Before it was done, Bear had sold something like 150% of himself, which of course didn't let Max grow rich. I knew Max, you know.
Oh, I knew that.
Yeah, when I was working for the McClatchys in Sacramento, Max was doing a disc jockey, really, job for them, for the radio station KFDK, which is right under the B when McClatchys were at 7th and I Streets. I think it was 7th and I. And I'd go by the window and see Max broadcasting his show there. Every now and then I'd see him in the bar right next to the place. What the hell? It was the Log Cabin. You see, we were very good friends with another really well-known entertainer, Charlie Marshall, who at one time was, for many years, was Master of Ceremonies at the National Barn Dance. He was selling farm equipment for the McClatchys in the early morning. He had a weird sense of humor. Charlie had a head so big he had to wear cowboy hats. He wore a size 20 shirt. But Max, I think he probably had one of the first pre-recorded DJ shows that there were. And it wasn't that Max wasn't willing to work the hours when the show was on. It was simply that the McClatchys couldn't trust Max to run that show without being able to edit it. Max just had to slip in a, didn't have to, just did inadvertently slip in a four-letter word now and then. He was playful as a puppy. Probably right up to the day he died, which was a heart very young. He was, I don't even know if he reached his 50s. But I have to remember him with a golf exhibition in which I believe Ernie Nevers was playing. Sam Snead was in it, and Dutch Harrison, who was a pro that was well known in those days. And Ernie Nevers, and I think a local pro. Nevers was a pretty good golfer. And Bear went along to be the referee. What they needed a referee in a golf match for, I don't know, but it was just strictly a publicity thing. And I'll never forget, on the first hole, Bear creeping up behind Nevers and throwing his arms around his neck and looking around at the press and grinning and saying, Ernie Nevers with a bear behind. He was just that kind of a guy. A nice guy, though. But they did have to tape his broadcast because of that. Anyway, I got away from it. I was talking about Manuel, I guess.
Well, I would get off the subject of the Independent, actually. I jumped about. But the Independent was both sports and news for you. How long did you do that, or what were some of the...
That I don't know. You know, I worked for the Independent 5 years. It just seems incredible to me that I would, but they paid me a sort of a double salary while I was. I remember it was kind of a shock to you when you made me the offer to go to work for the Times, and I said, Joan's paying me that much. And you just couldn't believe that, but you remember that that's what happened. And I was ready to leave because I thought the Independent was on its last legs. I have since learned that there was no way in the world the Independent had to ever be on its last legs. And I don't think I should go into that, but I have never really appreciated some of the circumstances in which the financial arrangements for that newspaper have been handled. I don't know why, but the most liberal publishers that I have had every single time have been the most tight-fisted and treated their employees the worst. Every single time. William Randolph Hearst was a great employer. Floyd Sparks is a great employer. Some of the liberals. I remember one in Southern California who paid me very well because he was paying me to be managing editor of three newspapers. Saying, leaning across the table at a cup of coffee and saying, you know, Walt, I'm supposed to be the great liberal down here, and I am the great liberal, but damn it, I'd like to get that union out of my back shop. Being a liberal doesn't mean you're a humanitarian. Experience over the years has told me that. Liberals may care about the masses, and every single time they think they're a cut above the masses and should treat them like messes, not masses. I really believe that. And that, I think, is the case with the newspaper in this valley.
Tell me about some of the editors you worked with in this event.
Of course, Pete Winslow was potentially a great newspaper man.
And a poet.
Well, Pete was a better poet when I first knew him in my mind than when he stopped. There are people who are supposed to know more about poetry than I do. But you know, the people who claim they know about poetry are the poets, and I think most poets are damn fools. They proclaim themselves poets and write poetry. I can write that stuff. And I can do a pretty damn good job of it. What they call a good job. But Winslow's good poetry was when his sense of humor was working for him when he was 26, 27 years old. But Winslow was a good newspaper man when he wanted to be one. And as an editor is concerned, as far as an editor is concerned, he was by far the best editor of the Independent, and I'll include Dana McGaw on that. I realize that McGaw did a lot for the Independent.
Set the standard for
some pace. He did set the pace, but McGaw was a runaway liberal a lot of times, and he wouldn't pace himself to his environment. Pete would, and he could. Pete was never he tried to be, if you remember, they were beatniks in those days, not hippies, and he tried to be a beatnik. But he had a problem. He had to put on a clean white shirt every day. He could act like a beatnik, but he couldn't do it without a clean white shirt, which didn't fit the picture. And that was Pete Winslow. His whole attitude on life. When he edited a paper, he did it with a certain amount of reason and common sense. He was basically a good newspaper man in some ways. I don't think unstable is a word, but he was so determined to be something apart. He wanted to be a great poet, he wanted to be a great writer, he wanted to be a great newspaper man. Always on his terms. And we can't always do that.
This is side one of tape two with Walt Hecox. Well, you were talking about Pete Winslow. I guess we talked quite a bit about him, but what happened to him now? He had
Well, what happened, you know, it's funny with Pete. They think about his demise as
really being more or less in Livermore. Pete was working for the News Register in Fremont when I went to work there. Now, I may have gone into that with you a little bit. I became the editor of the News Register more or less by default. They didn't know I have anybody there who knew how to edit a newspaper, really. And maybe Pete did, but well, psychologically he wasn't set up to edit that newspaper. And Pete had a habit of worrying himself. He was my Sunday editor. Made him very unhappy that I had him Sunday editor instead of city editor. But he was the ideal Sunday editor, and really, a good Sunday editor is hard to find, and a good city editor isn't as hard to find as a good Sunday editor. That may sound strange, but it's true, right? There were features and things that you needed on Sunday that took the type of imagination that Pete had, whereas the city editor had to just direct people and stories and so forth. He wasn't too happy about that. He wanted a job with the Chronicle, and he didn't get there. And he wasn't too happy about that. He had a habit of punishing himself. And it was while I was editor of the thing, and I used to say it never in relationship to him, that I didn't get ulcers, I gave him. And I said it kiddingly. And Pete was the guy I never put pressure on, because I never had to. Pete always did his job and did it well. I could see him in pain. He was also the education writer there. He won a couple of awards, actually.
He won that big apple award, or golden apple, or whatever that fellow did.
But I could see he was in pain, and I kept urging him to go see a doctor. And he eventually did. And I'll be damned if he didn't show up with an ulcer. And I would have to beg him to take care of that ulcer. Well, eventually, Pete quit to take a job at Camp Parks as a more or less a PR man, which is how he was introduced to the Valley over here.
The Job Corps.
Yeah. But he was working for the company that was running the job. I forget the name.
Litton Industries, yeah.
Litton Industries, yeah. And he was a good friend of Dana McGaw's. Long before that, he'd worked for Dana when Dana edited the LMA Times Star. Not Time Star, what is it? Is it the Time Star?
Yeah, okay. It is.
Anyway, for Abe Kaufman. And I didn't see much of Pete again until I went down, and Abe Kaufman bought this one, and I went down and edited those newspapers in California, in Southern California. And when I was damn near worn out, came back up here, and Pete got in touch with me through Fenn Troubridge. I wanted to rest, and I was selling stories just like that to the men's adventure magazines and getting pretty good prices. And I know it couldn't last. You're going to run out of stories with that type of stuff in a while, but I long enough for me to get some rest. And because in those days with that type of magazine, I was getting anywhere from $400 to $600 a story, which was damn near what would have been a month's pay in those days. And I was selling a couple of them a month, so I wasn't doing badly, but I knew I couldn't do it forever. I walked into the International Kitchen one day in Fremont, and Troubridge said, Pete Winslow is looking for you. And that's when I saw Pete, and when he said, I'd like to have you to come to work over here, And he mentioned a figure which was is not as low as Joan Kinney insists it was. It wasn't that low. But it wasn't very high. And I said, well, can I work just 8 hours a day? He promised me 8 hours a day. And he said, absolutely no more than 8 hours a day, any day. Well, that seemed like a vacation after that hell in Southern California. Well, I went to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, and my deadlines, as I think I've told you, were 2, 4, and 6, 8, 10, and 12. You know, 7 in the morning till 3:30 in the morning. And that's how I happened to come over here. Well, Pete quit as editor after a couple of years. I remember him taking me over to Granucci's and saying, I'm going to quit as editor and you're in top contention for the job. And I said, well, you go back over there and tell them that if they appoint me editor, they just lost Hecox. And that's what happened. And whether what Pete was telling me was true or not, I don't know. And I don't think the real truth will ever come out now, because if it was true, I don't think anybody would admit it now. Anyway, Bob became editor shortly thereafter, and shortly thereafter, Bob, not knowing about Pete's promise, asked me to take over the sports editor thing instead of the other.
Okay, then Pete didn't die in the job, and he was still alive when he quit.
He worked part-time for us. And he became very, very ill. And by then we had Kaiser Insurance, or maybe Jane had Kaiser Insurance, Pete's wife.
Pete's wife.
But he wound up in the Kaiser Hospital in San Francisco. I went up to see him the last time about a week before he died, and I promised to come back within the next few days, and before I could get back, why, he had died. And what had happened, basically, they explained it to me. His whole damn stomach had just really exploded as a result of whatever gases that ulcer was generating. He never stopped being Pete Winslow. When I walked into the ward, they asked me to stop at the door before I got all the way in the ward and all the way into his room, but he could see out of it. And they were working over him very hard when I got there, which is why they didn't want me to go in yet. Skeeter was with me at the time.
Skeeter was?
Yeah. Yeah, Jeanette had died.
Oh, you'd married Skeeter by that time?
Oh, yes. I think I married her, or we were engaged, one or the other. I think I'd married her. I'm sure I had. And so help me, he saw me while they're all working on him. And typical of Winslow was that spontaneous enthusiasm that he always had for everything. He sat up in bed and yelled "Hecox" at the top of his lungs while he was so sick he couldn't see what he was doing. And I talked to him, and he had all that enthusiasm and everything about him then. And a week later, we were at his funeral.
Where's that?
It wasn't a funeral. It was a memorial service. I forget. It was somewhere in the, I think it was in a school building. It may have been in a church along Dolores Street in San Francisco. And I remember that at Jeanette's funeral, he had been very impressed because I had had Johnny Cooper and Alan Smith, who plays the trumpet, and George Butterfield. It really should have been Vernon Alley, but Vernon couldn't get down, and George was a very close friend of Skeeter's on the bass.
Jeanette.
And they had been, they provided the music at Jeanette's funeral. I remember they played Sentimental Lady, Satin Doll, and Autumn in New York, which were three of her favorites. Two of them were Duke Ellington things, you know.
So Pete wanted him.
And Pete wanted Johnny, whom by then he knew very well through me, Johnny Cooper. Or rather, Jane wanted him. He'd always impressed him, and Jane called me and she said, "Do you think you can get John to play?" And I remember he played. And I remember as we got up and left, all through the services, which are really, they were a lot of these poets who were very, very dull. And as we got up and left, Johnny was playing the piano, and Skeeter started to cry. And I looked at her, and then I really heard the music. And you know what Johnny was playing? Lost Out There in the Stars. Johnny still had all of his touch in those days. That's where Pete is too, I think. Johnny still had all of his touch in those days. That's where Pete is too, I think. Where he always was, maybe. But that's what happened to Pete Winslow. He was very close to me the night that Jeanette died. The night after she was buried. I was alone and I couldn't stand to be in this valley. And I told Joe and Bob I had to have some time off. And I went. I went up toward the Mendocino Coast. I was going to Timber Cove because it looked like it would be solitary and beautiful and yet lonely. It turned out to be a hotbed joint. I got out of there after the first night. But I stopped on the way up. Johnny was playing at the Villa Roma at the time, which is that round hotel on Columbus Avenue. And Pete lived nearby, and I called Pete and asked him to meet me there. I took a room at the Villa Roma. I went down, and Johnny played the piano, and then they both came up to my room and spent, I guess, till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning just talking to me and making life bearable. Anyway, that's one editor. The other editor, the only other editor that I know at all well, is Bob Sevrel. And, frankly, I don't really want to talk about Bob. I don't think he was, is, or has ever been a good editor. And I think I feel a little bitter about him. Bob, at one time, and he's apologized for it since, wrote something about me which was a lie and which was cruel and which was totally unjustified. There was some bitterness about that. For some reason or another, I mean, and it was their feeling, the people of the Independent had the feeling that I have no right to work anywhere in the valley except the Independent. David Lowell felt very strongly that way. And when I told Joan that I was leaving, David came to me and he said, "You're going to work for Dean Lesher?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Are you going to be working here in the valley?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I'm going to be working in Walnut Creek," which was absolutely true.
That's right.
And he said, "Oh, well, that's fine." He said, "I'd feel very badly if you were working in the valley." Well, I didn't bother to tell him that I would be working for the Valley Times, but in Walnut Creek.
Right.
And I didn't think it was any of his business, and I don't think it was any of his business. I didn't, frankly, I think the Independent owed me more than I owed them. I had to collect $3,600 from Joan Kinney before I dared to quit, which I had loaned to her tax-free. And let the record show right here and now that Joan Kinney is an heir to Standard Register, which earns $50 million a year. And I feel very bitter about that. I'm sorry, but I do. I feel like I was trapped and cheated. And everybody who worked for him were. That is your liberal publisher. And I... You can put that on the record whether you want to or not, but it's true. Anyway.
You became managing editor of the...
I became managing editor at your request of the Times. And worked very happily for the Times as long as you were managing editor, which was for a far too short a period.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I remember the hectic day on which you quit, in which Mr. Dean Lesher called me up to his office right then. And I was a little nervous because I was afraid Nancy Ward might become managing editor. And eventually it became Steve Shelby.
Who also didn't last long.
Who was very compatible with me. Well, the situation was impossible at the time. It fortunately worked out very well to me. I kept my title of managing editor. I didn't keep the duties. I got to be a very, very, very elite roving reporter. Got to pick my own stories, my own series. Yeah, the result was I got to do a whole flock of series which really, really were good newspaper stories. And I think anybody who was reading the Times at the time would appreciate that.
I did.
And winding up with, of course, the Sinol thing, which got me the nomination for the Pulitzer, which I didn't win.
Certainly a highlight.
But yeah, it's probably the highlight of my journalistic career, and something which never could have happened if it hadn't been for that awful mix-up at the Times, where you had editors, my God, you had them, if you can call Al Fisher an editor, you had Al Fisher, you had John Edmonds, you had Steve Shelby, and you had me.
That was after I left.
I can remember Steve calling me into his office and saying, "Walt, I am no longer an editor." And I said, "Well, what are you doing in this office, Steve?" "And I'm only a managing editor." And thinking to myself, you know, what the hell's the difference? But, you know, babying him along and saying, "Now, Steve, take it easy. Everything will be all right."
Well, that was the merger you're talking about.
Yeah. But he couldn't. I mean, hell, Edmonds became the editor automatically when they merged the papers. Shelby couldn't stand the idea. Fisher, who was Edmund's man, became the managing editor until he pulled that great goofo with the Sinol story. And I was out being a roving reporter having the time of my life, and I didn't care as long as I got the money.
You're still writing Sound and Fury, too.
Yeah, I was still writing Sound and Fury, and I was out there writing the other series, and I writing an editorial now and then, just having a fine time. Hell, if it had gone like that forever, I'd have been happy, but the rest of them were a little bit more worried about their egos, I guess, than I was, because, I mean, hell, I'd been an editor a few times, and I didn't find any great benefits in being an editor. I never have. The benefits are listening to politicians talk, going to editorial conferences, which are a pain in the ass, and listening to publishers talk, which is no great joy either.
No, that's right. That only lasted until Steve left, right?
Then they made me managing editor again, and then they had a big economy firing. Depression 73 came along, a recession or whatever you wanted to call it. And in order to avoid firing anybody else, I took over the combined duties of city editor and managing editor.
And Dr. Nancy Ward left, yeah. She left.
And it became a... the situation there became very, very difficult. One thing, John lived in the wrong place. The Edmonds did. They lived on 2nd Street in Pleasantville. That put them within easy hearing distance of 1st Street, where the big gravel trucks drove by. And those trucks became an obsession with John Edmonds, and I don't really blame him. And because Don Murphy couldn't find any fair or just way, and I think those same trucks are still going down that same street.
Yes.
And I timed them. And in the daytime, there was a truck about every 45 seconds. But John wanted Don Murphy to get those trucks off those streets, and when Don couldn't or wouldn't do it, he decided to get Don Murphy, no matter what happened. Then came fast-talking Valerie Raymond. I, in the meantime, had hired a very good, very, very inexperienced reporter, Rodriguez, who wanted to make a reputation for himself. And he didn't realize what a lot of young reporters don't realize, and particularly not out here in the sticks, and that is that you have to check your facts. You just can't go out and be told something by one person and print it. You have to check them all the way through. Well, it also apparently was a lesson John hadn't learned, because he would try to print these stories and I would stop them. And where John and I had gotten along very well to begin with, why, all of a sudden friction developed between John Edmonds and I. Because John would start these stories going through and I would stop them. And it led to a certain strain between the two of us. And something else was happening at the time which was unfortunate, and that was a certain amount of friction between Jean, who was really a wonderful woman. Now, there are people who worked for that paper who would tell you otherwise, but Jean was really a great person. But she had grown up as a farm girl. She had the farm girl attitude toward employees, and they were employees, and you raise your hand when you go to the John, and you speak when you're spoken to, and doesn't work with young newspaper people. And I was having one hell of a time being a buffer between Jean Edmonds and the staff. And it got to the point where the whole staff rebelled one day. And Mike Zampa, I told them, I said I would go talk to John, but they might not have Walt Heacock as a buffer anymore when I did. And Mike suggested that I call in Warren,
Warren Barry.
I called in Warren, and Warren took the tiger by the tail and talked to John, and I guess it was I didn't get in that talk at all. I didn't want to. And a memo was issued that gave all of Gene's authority to me. Almost predictably, 90 days after that, I was gone. It was an unfortunate situation, and I want to say right here and now that I don't know of... He's a good writer, and with the basic training, everybody should have some small town newspaper training. But John, on the other hand, needed some metropolitan training too. Basically, he was a good newspaper man, and I have never known two people that I thought were finer people than John and Gene Edmonds, and I'm very, very deeply regretful. Gene's dying. There were two fine people. We had our differences, but I really, really, when the last time I saw him, I think it was at the CNPA convention, and we were good friends, and I really enjoyed them. That, of course, is when I went to work for Floyd Sparks. And
you made that switch overnight, too, didn't you?
Oh, that was fast, just overnight.
Floyd came right here to see you, didn't he?
He came to this house, yeah. And I don't think, I think I can list my favorite publishers on three fingers. And they would be, and not necessarily in this order, I couldn't pick the order. They would be Floyd Sparks, Eleanor McClatchy, and William Randolph Hearst. Now, Eleanor is the liberal among them. But if the McClatchys are liberal, I've never been sure what they were. They are what they are. They are unique in the newspaper business. Hearst was a great employer. I don't think anybody who's ever worked for Hearst will ever tell you anything different. And Floyd Sparks, I thought, was a good employer. You may have disagreed, but I thought he was.
No, I like him. Still like
him. I think Floyd Sparks is a great person. I admire Dean Lister. I think he's brilliant. But I really liked Floyd Sparks until that last 6 months when that little worm was eating the guts out of that organization. I welcomed Floyd Sparks coming to that office. At the end of that time, when I thought Sparks might be around, I got out of the place. I didn't want to talk to him, but it wasn't Floyd that had to be getting out. I can't tell you, Skeeter kept asking me to go talk to Floyd, and I had tried to once, and he had rejected me, and I guess changed his mind. But I after that, I hadn't changed mine. I had my private war to fight.
Yeah. Well, you were editor of the Tri-Valley News for how long? Let's see.
3 years.
3 years, okay.
Yeah, four years with Floyd, and 3 years as
editor of there.
Editor of
That's
there.
Right, you started out as columnist, didn't you?
Yeah.
We had you writing it.
Yeah. And I enjoyed that up there. I really did. I didn't enjoy the two women. They were woman's livers to the point where they were constantly on the defensive. One of them could have been very nice. I always thought that Beverly could have been a very nice person. She was a complainer, and I think probably she was a complainer all her life. She complained about little things, and get used to that way and ignore it. Why? She had a beautiful laugh and a sense of humor, and she was a very human being. The other one I don't want to talk about. I think one of the pleasures to work with I had up there was a woman who wasn't popular at all with most people, and that was, what was my little reception?
Carol.
But Carol was highly efficient, and she was really a wonderful person. I can remember telling Carol, I said, Carol, one of the big complaints with me is that I am not organized. And frankly, as far as my details, I'm not organized. I said, no, I want you to organize me. And she came in and she organized me and she took care of my filing, and once a week she would come in and make sure that I was still organized. And I stayed organized that way. And she did it very efficiently and very painlessly for both of us. And she was so good. Really, really so good. She had a lot of problems, personal problems, and maybe they came to the office with her a little bit. Carol Barrett.
Barrett, yes.
And she wrote a really cute little column for us, too. What you call it? Some kind of pins. It was a pun.
Yeah. Their daughter wrote a horse column, didn't she?
Mm-hmm. But Carol, she was a pleasure to have up there. And then, of course, I got lucky. I swiped Pat Kennedy from the Times. And then I swiped Bill Cobble from the Times. Every time I'd lose a reporter, I'd steal somebody from the Times. I was running out of people I could steal. But I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the relationship with you. As long as you were around, everything was great.
Yeah, and I left again.
Then you left again, and Floyd Sparks came over, and it's a funny thing. He asked me everything about Tom York except whether or not I liked him. Now, I couldn't give a bad report on York. If he'd asked me if I liked him, I'd have said, hell no.
But
he didn't ask that. And as far as I knew, and probably it's still true, I thought Tom was a perfectly reasonable newspaper man. I think he was in over his head when he was associating with that other worm. But it wasn't the same relationship that you and I had. And I thought we had a good one, and I thought we were producing a good product in these two valleys.
Sure.
But it's funny that in each paper, why, you get me into it, and then you desert me. Sort of what I...
One of tape three and...
Oh, this is what I've met Ed Sullivan, and he introduced me to these detective stories. I remember the first one I wrote was Thomas McMonigal and Thora Chamberlain, which was a kidnapping murder right over here. I told you about it. At least I told you about Jimmy going down the face of that cliff to take those pictures. He murdered the girl as she left Camel High School. Kidnapped her.
Carmel?
No, Camel.
Camel.
Right over here in the other side of Santa Fe.
Oh, that was
it. It was a little cannery town in those days. Now it's just lost in the Santa Clara Valley, you know. It's by Hamilton Road there. You probably don't know the valley like
I
do. I forget. I grew up in the Santa Clara Valley. But anyway, she was kidnapped there, and he took her to Saddle Rock, right below Devil Slide, the slide on US 1 that they have all the trouble with, and threw her into the ocean there. The ocean hits very hard there, very pounding waves. I think one of Thora's socks was found in some other article of clothing. That's all that was ever found of her. But they did convict McMonigal of her murder, and he was executed for it. That was the first one. I don't know how many hundred there have been after that. I did a lot of fiction during that period for the sports pulps. I did some fiction for Slick magazine. When I wrote the fiction in those days, I wrote it was a style I had developed, which people I guess would accuse me of swiping from Damon Runyon, but it was a first-person present tense, but not his type of first-person present tense. I always use it for the fiction. My theory with fiction was to keep them moving, and I did that. I wrote a lot of sports stories, mostly boxing stories, all fiction, and they got to the point where they had my name out on the cover of these pulps. And as I say, I sold to some Slick magazines. Then I started selling articles. Magazines that paid me a little bit better. With the detective stories being the base for it forever. And when...
I can't get it out. Go ahead.
And when the... when the thing was... I did that for quite a long time. But then I began to get a little bit afraid in the late 50s when television was really horning in and killing those magazines like mad. I had 12 magazines quit publication one Christmas. 12 of them.
Both of them.
Yeah. Five of the... Five. There's six of these, six of the sports books and six of the detective magazines. And that was scary. I started writing, I wrote some books and sold some of them for soft cover stuff. But I didn't have the facility that you really needed to make money at those things. And that is, you had to have one on the outline stage, one working and one being concluded. And that's just about what you had to do those days to make a living with those books. And I couldn't focus on three plots at once. I just couldn't do it.
Not many people can.
I could write them fairly fast. One of them was a pretty successful. I wound up not writing those under my own name because the first one was That Perfumed World, and that was the most successful one, and that was about the American Kennel Club and the dog shows, and as I say, I'd have been kicked out of the AKC if they had known I wrote that book.
Right.
I think they all guessed I did. Then, when one of those book contracts went haywire, I actually went to Johnny Howe, who was that time Coast County's editor of the Mark, and said, "Johnny, can you get me one of those circulation jobs in the early morning at the Mark just so I can hang on until I get this book contract straightened around?" He says, "Hell, you don't want to do that, Walt." He says, "There's a job open up in Fremont." And he says, "You can be editor of that paper in a month." Well, I went up and took the job, which was putting out a special edition.
1960 or somewhere.
And they were in terrible trouble with that. They didn't have a stick of copy up. 235 pages of advertising sold. And no time at all left. Well, I wrote it and made it up and got the thing out for them. It had about $250,000 worth of advertising sold, so I really saved that paper a lot of money. And when it was all over, they made me editor of the paper.
It was George Oakes' paper, News Register,
yeah.
Right?
And that's how it all started. They made me news editor first, and then they made me editor.
Okay. Well, to go back to what we were talking about, the detective stories, you didn't jump back into detective story writing until 1980, really?
No, I didn't. I did write some stuff for Phil Hirsch for Pyramid Publications. But I was selling I wasn't selling much more than six or seven stories a year. I was getting a fair amount of money for the stories from Hirsch. I mean, more than I am from the detective stories now. Hirsch, he kept raising me all the time, giving me more money, and he was pretty fair with me. Phil has always been one of my favorite editors.
Pyramid, though, what?
Well, Pyramid Books, it's now, I forget who owns it now, but they were sold eventually. Phil is now with Filmways, which is basically a motion picture producing outfit. I don't think he's in the motion picture producing end, but I don't know exactly what he's doing, but Phil is always... He was the vice president of Pyramid, and it was one of the best-known softcover book companies. It was up there in the same class with Dell. What I wrote for him was Man's Magazine.
Oh, he owned that too. That's part of Man's Magazine. Okay. When, now you're into three magazines all owned by the same company?
Five
magazines owned by the same company. Which are they?
Two divisions with one central editor. There's True Detective, Official Detective, and Master Detective. Those are the really old ones, and they're edited by Art Crockett. He is the executive editor. Then there's Front Page Detective and Inside Detective. They are the old Dell books, and they are edited by Rose... Oh my God!
No, come back to that. Well, there. What?
Anyway, Art is actually the executive editor of them too.
So it's one company overall. About
Reese Publications.
Reese. Okay.
Reese Communications. That's what they call themselves.
And you're writing about how many now?
How many months a year?
I did about 45 last year.
45, that's pretty good, nearly one a week.
Well, I figure I should do one a week.
And you're limited to what part of Northern California?
I've got about 37 counties. I've got just about all of Northern California now because the guy with the examiner who was doing it just hasn't been doing anything for them, so Art told me to go over to him and do the San Francisco stories. And then I had San Francisco for the Dell books anyway, so I can do it about anywhere I want from the Oregon border down to about Bakersfield. Did a Santa Barbara story this summer, right? A very good detective story, a very grim story.
Okay, so that, how many words do you average in your story? What do you?
It all depends. The regular stories go 4,000 to 6,000 words. Sometimes I do what they call a double length story. I get paid twice as much money for them, and they run about 8,000 words.
Plus photos, right?
Yeah.
You either take them or you.
I usually take them, and I take them with a Polaroid. Well, the Polaroid is insurance for me. He'd like the devil to travel 200, 250 miles and take a lot of pictures and come home and find you've got nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
Also, there's a time element.
But they're black and white, is that right?
Nope.
Are you doing color?
They don't like it, but...
But they're color Polaroid shots.
Mm-hmm. You can't buy a black and white Polaroid, I don't think.
Oh, that's right, anymore, yeah. Only in special 4x5 laboratories.
Well, we've got some that we can do, but I'd need a special camera. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't have the lens this one's got.
And you just started, let's talk about the writing instruments. You started out with an old manual typewriter, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And your career, and you jumped to electric typewriter, and then you jumped to a BDT. And when did you jump to BDT? When Valentine's, or was that up in Danville when you went to the BDT system?
Danville.
Okay.
And I was using an electric typewriter in 1958, though, when I lost these fingers.
Okay.
About 1963, I guess, 62 or 63. I don't know exactly what I lost, but maybe 1960.
I was printing on a.
Mm-hmm.
On a hand press.
Yeah, hand press that I had in my basement. Slipped. It snapped. That's why they call them snappers, I guess.
Yeah.
But then, so I was using that IBM was so sensitive in those days, you'd bow on it and those keys would go. It took me time to learn to use it. Yeah. But then I went from that to the, I went back when I, went back to the newspapers, the regular typewriter. And then from there, through all that metamorphosis we all did, the IBM Selectric was the beginning of it, and they all had those, and they put those in the computer sheets.
Yeah.
And then from there to the VDT, which I never really mastered. And then we had trouble. They had the wrong kind of power up there in that so-called office we had in Danville.
Didn't have enough, you mean it was too weak a line?
It had power surges or something. It kept blowing out the computers.
Okay.
So then when I got into this, I saw what I was spending for typing, and I thought that, and it added up to quite a bit of money a year. And at the present rate, it would be $1,200 a year. Well, now that's quite a bit of money. So I figured my age against how much many productive years I could figure on having, and I very stupidly figured, well, I can afford about $2,000 for a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got very, very lucky. Through Stan Greenspan at the San Ramon School District, I was put onto this Pied Piper computer. I think it's got the largest memory of any small personal computer there is. I got 900K. I get 900K on those disks. And I'm getting a second drive on it.
Well, you are, you're adding.
Yeah. But I got that computer, the software, the Smith Corona TPI printer, which is far from the best printer in the world, but it is a letter quality printer, which I needed. And the viewer, and I put that whole thing together, I think, for about $2,250. Mm. Well, it's making about an extra $500 a month.
Saving typing.
So my, not typing.
Oh, well, you're able to write
extra
more.
Production.
Okay, you can write faster.
Yeah.
Hmm. You still subscribe to the clipping service, don't you?
Still subscribe to the clipping seal service, and I some of my typing money goes because I'm now sending these things back east to express mail. I just have lost all faith in our mail service. I don't know what excuse there is for operating anything as inefficiently as the United States mail is operated, or as whimsically.
Tell me about clipping service now. This is a clipping service out of San Francisco.
San Francisco. It's been there for years. Ellen's Press Clipping
sure.
Bureau.
Ellen's, but it does it selectively picks for you.
Picks me murders as they occur and as they are adjudicated. That's all I need to know.
That gives a seed for your...
That's story. Right. I couldn't take them all. We've talked over it. It is my bill goes over 100 clippings a month. That isn't $100. The clippings, I think, cost me about $30 a month. A little more than that. I go over 100 clippings. It costs me more. But not much. I get up to 130, 140 clippings sometimes. Then it gets expensive.
You don't attempt to put those on the computer, though, as far as topics or...
Oh, no.
Chronologically, there's no need for that.
Oh, yeah, I do that.
Chronologically?
I keep a file notice to myself. I don't use it in the filer on that thing, which I've never been able to find. I can find Perfect Calc, but their Perfect Filer I haven't found yet. I don't know everything about that computer. I know what I have to know. And I keep a file of my own on the Perfect Writer, which... what it keeps is what stories I have filed on, what stories have been approved, and then what stories have been written. It's just, it's very simple because I simply change the designation at the end of the stories after they're taken care of. But that's another thing with the computer, which is absolutely great. All that wad of paper, and I had it all over the world. Why, now it's reduced to... I can get, I got 8 stories on the last disc and 2 of them were double length. Now that's about 60,000 words.
Wow, one disc. Cover yourself, do you duplicate that on another disc in case one disc is destroyed?
It should. To have the thing now, I haven't, but I will just as soon as I get the new machine.
The second disk drive. So
the second disk drive, yeah.
That way you can duplicate your disks.
I can duplicate them now, but it's a very tedious task.
With the second disk drive, you'll be able to do that. Well, I think we've, on the tape, reached a good conclusion, because talking right up to date now about computers, and starting out back in the 40s and earlier, we haven't talked in detail about a lot of staff members, but that's impossible to cover all the personalities you've run across in the years. So today is January 2nd, 1984, and we're finishing up on an interview that spanned several months, actually. So I'll turn it off.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right.